All right. Hey, we're going to continue this series that we started last week, our Builder series. We're looking at the stories of people who built something and left their mark, whether it be a wall, whether it be a building, a temple, or an example for us to follow, that somehow left their mark on our faith and how we observe our faith today. Before we get into that, though, I want to talk about fences. Now, when we bought our house a couple years ago, we have little dogs that like to, one of them particularly, likes to just run off. And then I think he gets a few blocks away and then realizes, like, oh no, now what? But then he's too dumb to just turn around and come back home, so he just goes gallivanting all over the countryside. So we needed to keep them in, right? Well, there was no fence around the yard. And so priority one after functional bathroom in our house was a fence, because we were all getting tired of putting the dogs on a lead every time they had to go outside to take care of their business. And they were getting tired of being on a lead and only being able, because we have a fairly decent sized yard, but they could only enjoy like this much of it, you know, because they were on a lead. So we finally got this fence done, and it was really kind of funny to watch at first when we let them outside and they were waiting to be put on a lead, but then they realized they weren't being put on a lead, and they were able to venture out, and they kept looking back at us, and then finally they just, boom, they were off, running around in circles. And it was hilarious because they're both really, really dumb because they're dogs, but hey, that's why we love dogs. They ran full on smack into each other. Boom, head-on collision. Both just got shook their heads and were like, okay, whatever. And they just kept running around because they were overjoyed to be able to run around inside the fence. So our fence was really built for one purpose, to keep our dogs in. I'm not really concerned about things from the outside getting into our yard because it's only like a 3-foot fence because our dogs are little and dumb. You know, well, then, of course, then we inherit all these other bigger dogs. You know, one of them, Lily, who came with our bonus kid, Adam, had never really seen a fence before because she was always out in the country. And so this 3-foot tall fence was like nothing for her. She just leaped over it whenever she felt the need to. And now Garrett's dog is a 90-pound toddler, and he's just too dumb to realize that he could leap over that fence, but he just likes to go lean up against it all the time. I'm like, dude, you're big. Stop leaning on my fence. You're going to knock it over. Okay. But anyways, not terribly concerned about like the deer that want to jump over the fence and come in and eat my grass. Because it's kind of fun to then let the dogs out, you know, and see my little, well, okay, she's a little pudgy, 20-pound pug go up to a deer like she's going to kick its butt, you know, and the deer just doesn't even care. But anyways, not concerned about things from the outside getting in. That's not why I built the fence. I built the fence to protect what was inside. Now, how many of you have a vegetable garden around here? Deer, vegetable garden. See, you want to build a fence around here to keep the marauding raiders from infiltrating and stealing all of your hard work, don't you? When we're able to put in a garden, we haven't yet, but when we're able to, you better believe I'm putting up a fence. Because if I'm doing all that work, it's because I want to eat corn on the cob, not because I want deer to eat corn on the cob, right? So the fence in that situation is to keep stuff out and protect what's inside. See the difference between the two? Well, the builder that we're looking at today didn't necessarily build a fence, but something similar to protect what was inside from the marauding raiders on the outside. Today we're looking at Nehemiah. In Nehemiah, when we first encounter him, he was in the Persian capital city of Susa. Sound familiar? That's where we first encounter Esther as well. But Nehemiah came about 20, 30 years after the events of the book of Esther. And Nehemiah was in King Artaxerxes' court. and had a very trusted position. A little rabbit trail. It's a little minor controversy what his role actually was in King Artaxerxes' court. Most traditionally, we say he was the cupbearer. The cupbearer was not just the guy who stood there and handed the king his cup. That was part of his role, but really he was in charge of the wine inventory in the king's court and had to taste the wine to see if it was poison. Great job, right? Because if someone's trying to assassinate the king, who's actually going to die? You, the cupbearer, because you're tasting the wine before you give it to the king, right? Well, the controversy comes in this thing we call the Septuagint. If you're familiar with that, it's a collection of 70 books. Septuagint is 70 in Greek. 70 books that were translated from the original Hebrew into Greek. And it's something we rely upon a lot for the Greek translations and correlations, you know, between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Well, in some early translations, some early manuscripts of the Septuagint, the role of Nehemiah is changed a little bit. The words are extremely similar between the cupbearer and eunuch. Now, either role would have had a very close, trusted relationship to the king, so it doesn't really make a big difference to us what Nehemiah's role really was. Big difference to Nehemiah, however. What that has to do with our message for today? Absolutely nothing. But you know me, I like interesting tidbits about people, okay? Because the more human we make them, the more we realize that they are human, right? Just like us. These aren't people that were born with halos on their heads and in stained glass. They were flesh and blood people just like us. So, whatever Nehemiah's role was, he was a close, trusted person in the court of King Artaxerxes. And when we first encounter him there, he receives news that the returned exiles to Judah are not doing well. So let's turn to Nehemiah chapter 1, starting right in verse 1. It says, "These are the memoirs of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In late autumn, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes' reign, I, that being Nehemiah, was at the fortress of Susa. Hannah and I, one of my brothers, came to visit me with some other men who had just arrived from Judah. I asked them about the Jews who had returned there from captivity and about how things were going in Jerusalem. They said to me, 'Things are not going well for those who returned to the province of Judah. They are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem has been torn down and the gates have been destroyed by fire.'" So, in response to this news, so Nehemiah is realizing the deer are getting in to the capital city. They're eating all the corn on the cob, right? The city of Jerusalem is left helpless with no defenses. And so Nehemiah is troubled by this, and he wants to do something about it. So he approaches the king and asks permission to go back home. "Can I go and help with the restoration of the walls around the city of Jerusalem?" So, keep in mind, though, what this really means for the city of Jerusalem and the exiles who've returned. This is not just about protection. Because did you catch that, what was reported to him by Hanani? They're in great trouble and disgrace. Their capital city, the city of David, where the temple of God is not only defenseless, but it's been lying in a heap of ruins for about 100 years. So the identity, the people of God, God's chosen people who were led into the promised land, their crown jewel of a city is a heap of rubble. civic disgrace. And with all these people that have returned, as God promised, he would restore his people, right? So he brings them back from exile, back to Judah, Jerusalem, and it seems like it's one step forward, 58 steps back. Because every time they seem to get a little bit of a foothold, every time they start to make a little bit of progress, what happens? Because the walls of the city have been destroyed and the city's lying defenseless. The robbers come in, steal whatever progress they've made. So the people in Judah, the returned exiles, again, flesh and blood people, put yourselves in their shoes. They're back there struggling, trying to scratch out a life, and every time they make a little bit of progress, it gets stolen away from them. They have to be wondering, like, okay, what's so great, God, about this restoration that you promised us? What's so wonderful about being back here? You have to even wonder if some of them were thinking about maybe going back to Persia. Because, yeah, at least we weren't home, but at least we didn't have to worry about all this other stuff. Again, these were just flesh and blood people who had to have been thinking the same thing that we would think now. But obviously God had a different plan in store. And this is where he works things in ways that we wouldn't think of. Because he once again uses a foreign power to carry out his plan. Because remember, years ago, decades before this, he used Babylon as the wooden spoon to wake his people up from all their rebellion by taking them into exile. And now he's using the Persian Empire to fuel their rise from this exile. Because King Artaxerxes agrees to let Nehemiah go. And Nehemiah not only leaves and just to go back as your average rank and file dude going back to Jerusalem to help the building project, Artaxerxes names him the new governor and gives him a fistful of royal decrees authorizing all the projects that Nehemiah wants to do, namely rebuilding the walls around the city, and gives him a whole bunch of signed requisition orders. Whatever materials you need, all your neighbors are going to be more than happy to provide those for you, Nehemiah. They're going to do it with a smile on their face. Right. Because, and think about this from Artaxerxes' point of view. The Persian Empire was known for basically letting all the people they conquered keep being who they were. They didn't force them to become more like Persian, whatever that would look like. They got to be who they wanted to be, as long as they kept paying taxes. The Persian Empire didn't care. Just keep giving us riches and treasure. Pay your taxes. So Artaxerxes is looking at this struggling hovel filled with peasants and thinking, if you go back there and rebuild these walls, now we can have a stable economy filled with business owners and people who are earning a living and paying taxes. By all means, go back. And here's all that you need to make me more money. That's really why Artaxerxes was so willing to empower Nehemiah to go back there and carry out God's will and God's plan. Does it matter what Artaxerxes' motives were? No. God can use anything to bring about his will. And that's exactly what he does again by using a foreign power to bring about what he wants to see happen. So now, let's just cut to the chase real quick. Nehemiah gets back there. There's some opposition, understandably. The people who were there that wanted to keep stealing from the Judeans, they weren't very happy that this work was going to continue or was going to be completed. Nehemiah didn't care. And in 52 days, before the invention of hydraulics and power tools, 52 days, the walls were rebuilt around the entire city of Jerusalem. Absolutely mind-boggling. I don't know that that project could be done in 52 days today with the modern tools that we have. Probably because there'd be too many permits to file. But anyways, less than 2 months, the walls around the city of Jerusalem were rebuilt. That is absolutely insane how they were able to do this. But the reason why we're really looking at Nehemiah today is not because we need to build better fences to keep our dogs in, or better fences to keep the deer out of our gardens. Walls are walls. Fences are fences. So it's not the physical wall of protection that Nehemiah built that I think we really need to be spending a lot of time paying attention to. It's more the walls of integrity that we protect ourselves with, that we protect our families with. Those are the walls that I think we can look to Nehemiah's example and examine in our own lives. How his example and how he rebuilt those physical walls can help us build the walls that we need to protect ourselves and our families. These walls of morality, integrity. And so there's three things specifically that I want to look at from Nehemiah's example. And the first, I think if Nehemiah and the people of Judah were to teach us anything, it's that in following Christ, we have to commit fully. No halfway. Following Jesus is a full commitment. We see this in Nehemiah, if we go on to chapter 4. Like I mentioned, there was some opposition, namely these two guys, one of whom has a really odd name, Sanballat. That was his name. You can't make this stuff up. Sanballat was his name. And Tobiah. They were leaders of the other people that were in that area who, again, did not want to see the walls around Jerusalem get rebuilt because they wanted to keep getting rich off of what the Judeans were able to start to put together. So they were threatening all kinds of opposition. But then in verse 6, it says, at last the wall was completed to half its height around the entire city, for the people had worked with enthusiasm. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs, Ammonites, and Ashdodites heard that the work was going ahead and that the gaps in the wall of Jerusalem were being repaired, they were furious. They all made plans to come and fight against Jerusalem and throw us into confusion. But we prayed to our God and guarded the city day and night to protect ourselves. And why? Because they were not going to start, or they were not going to finish with the walls only half as high as they needed to be. They were going to continue the work, even in the midst of the opposition, even with now threats of actual, you know, invasions and battles to be fought, even with their protection only half done, they were going to continue. Nothing was going to deter them from building the wall that they needed to build. They were fully committed. And there just simply isn't room for a half-hearted commitment when it comes to protecting our integrity. We, as followers of Christ, have a set of standards to live by. We have a moral code written for us in the truth of God. And there's no way that we can approach following Jesus half-heartedly. And now know this, of course. The world around us is always going to seek to marginalize anyone who opposes groupthink. Just look at what's happening in our cities today. Name your cause, whatever it is. Somebody somewhere is peacefully protesting something because someone had the audacity to have a different opinion or to say something or do something that didn't line up with the way they thought it should have happened. And so, of course, the only recourse is to try to eliminate that from society. Cancel culture. I am completely sick and tired of cancel culture. Anybody else? I love the fact that we live in a country that allows ourselves the freedom to agree to disagree. And I desperately, passionately want the day to return when we can actually agree to disagree on some things. Amen? Okay, now that was totally off topic. Not really. Okay. But the rest of the world set us standards. They're going to seek to marginalize and minimize or even silence a biblical worldview. It's already happening. Biblical worldviews are being increasingly branded as hateful, exclusive, and name your other words that you want to throw in there. But I've said it before, and I will continue to say it. The truth doesn't care about your opinions. The truth is the truth, irrespective of how you feel about it. And there is no varying degrees of truth. There is no your truth, my truth, their truth, whoever's truth. There is only truth, and there is untruth. And as followers of Christ, committed fully to living according to His truth, we cannot hem and haw on that stuff. We have to commit fully. This is something echoed in Jesus' teachings in Luke chapter 9, starting in verse 57. It says, as they were walking along, someone said to Jesus, I will follow you wherever you go. But Jesus replied, foxes have dens to live in and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to even lay his head. He said to another person, come, follow me. The man agreed, but he said, Lord, first let me return home and bury my father. But Jesus told him, let the spiritually dead bury their own dead. Your duty is to go and preach about the kingdom of God. Another said, yes, Lord, I will follow you, but first let me say goodbye to my family. But Jesus told him, anyone who puts a hand to the plow and then looks back is not fit for the kingdom of God. Now, at first reading, it seems like Jesus is being a little harsh here. You know, especially with the guy who's saying, hey, let me go bury my dad. Because we read that and we think, dad just died. Okay, just let me go to the funeral and then I'm all yours. The reality, though, in this situation, guy was saying, no, dad's at home in the Lazy Boy. Let me just hang out until the day should happen to come when my dad dies. Then I'll come find you, wherever you are. That's the situation that was really happening there. And Jesus' whole point is just, look, you're either in or you're not. You know, and like to the, let me go say goodbye to my family first. No, if you say you're going to follow me, then follow me. None of this putting conditions on it. Let me first go take care of this, and then, you know, I have this checklist of things I have to do to get everything in order, and then I will commit fully to you. Jesus is just saying, you're either in or you're not. If you say you're going to follow me, then follow me. Everything else comes secondary. First and foremost, I am a follower of Christ. Everything else comes after that. That's committing fully in our relationship with God. That's committing fully to our integrity and the set of standards by which, if we're going to call ourselves a follower of Christ, how we will live in that followership of Christ. The second thing I think that we can learn from the example of Nehemiah is, first, commit fully. And when it comes to integrity, you know, morality in our lives, fix your wall first. Fix your wall first. You know, if you look in the book of Nehemiah, chapter 3, it seems a bit tedious. It's just a list. This family, this guy, they built that section of the wall, and then the next so many feet were built by this guy, and so on, 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 and this gate was rebuilt by this person, and blah, 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 blah. That's it. It kind of gets lumped into the category of all those census results, you know, and all the genealogies, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so-and-so. And it's one of those things like, okay, God, I know you put this in here for a reason, but why? because, man, this is some dry, boring reading. It's okay to admit that, by the way. But it is in there for a reason. In this particular case, first, it's a systematic record of sectional repairs, progressing the entire perimeter. Anybody here have cows? You put that fence up and then you never have to worry about it again, right? No, cows find the holes, don't they? Cows will make their own holes, won't they? So you have to check them. You have to check the fence, right? You have to periodically, systematically know the status of the entire perimeter of the fence, don't you? And that's what Nehemiah is doing. Systematically checking the fences and providing that example for us to systematically know the status of the walls protecting my integrity. What am I allowing into my life? What exactly am I allowing to inform my decisions? What's going on in this sin, sick, fickle thing that's beating in my chest? Systematically, every single one of us is responsible for knowing the status of the walls, protecting our integrity, not just individually, but for our families as well. We have to know their condition. And the second thing in chapter 3 in Nehemiah shows us is that each family was responsible for working on the section of the wall right in front of their face. They didn't have to go, you know, all over the city to repair things. They were responsible for repairing the part that was most vital to them, to protect their family, their neighborhood. That's the part that they were in charge of repairing. You know, and the whole phrase, it takes a village to raise a child, we get that sentiment, and it's true to a point, but it falls apart when the individual assumes the village will just handle it. The village is made up of individuals, and my children are still my responsibility. I can't just rely upon the village to raise my kids. I count on y'all to help. But the part that's most important to me and my family, that's what I'm responsible for. And that's what Nehemiah chapter 3 shows us. Is that basically if each person sees to their own integrity, if each person fixes their walls first, and their family's walls, what's going to happen on the bigger scale? What'll happen in the bigger picture? All of a sudden, we'll look around our community and we'll have stronger walls. We'll have stronger integrity. We'll have better morality here. I don't know about you, but I'm all in for that. I want this community to be fundamentally transformed. Because boy, do we need us some more Jesus. And I'm not picking on Dayton. This is global. But you and I can't do a lot globally. But we can do a lot right here. But it starts with me. And each one of you as individuals knowing the condition of your walls, your integrity, your morality, and your families, and protecting that at all costs. You know, there's another thing happening here too, I think. Because again, put yourself in these individual flesh and blood people's shoes. Imagine you're working on your section of wall, and along comes Nehemiah with his clipboard. And he asks you your name, and he writes it down, and then he measures this section out, and he's taking all of his notes and saying, okay, this one's yours. You're responsible for it. Is your attention to detail going to improve a little bit? Knowing your name is forever attached to that section? Probably. I know mine would. Because if your section of the wall ever fails and the enemy gets through that section, we all know who failed in their duties. And so, of course, their attention to detail ramped up a little bit, because not only were they focusing on their wall and protecting their family, that also puts it back into the community aspect, doesn't it? Because yes, I'm responsible for me. I'm responsible for my family. I'm also responsible for my family's contribution to our community. And this all puts that in perspective. To me, it kind of echoes Joshua's challenge. Joshua chapter 24, verse 15. This is when God's people were getting ready to cross over into the promised land. And I just love how straightforward and to the point Joshua is. Verse 15, if you refuse to serve the Lord, then choose today whom you will serve. Would you prefer the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates, or will it be the gods of the Amorites in whose land you now live? But as for me and my family, we will serve the Lord. And I absolutely love just how straightforward and to the point he is. Basically saying, get off the fence. Look, if you're not going to serve God, figure out today who you're going to serve. And then just go that direction. No more hemming and hawing. Again, what was our first point today? Commit fully. If you're in, you're in. If you're halfway in, you're out. Commit fully. That's the only way. It's through personal responsibility that we'll be able to prevail in integrity and our family's integrity and have a positive impact on the rest of our community, is with that personal accountability and responsibility. And that leads to the final lesson from Nehemiah for today. Pray and proact. Now, going through the entire book of Nehemiah, a very consistent theme is he gives all of his concerns, all of his issues, all of his heartache, all of his struggles, consistently goes to God with all of those. Consistently leads the people around him in prayer and seeking God's will and guidance. And then he takes action. He doesn't stop at seeking God's will, knowing God's will, he then puts it into practice. And sometimes I think people imagine the stories of Israel and Judah, you know, of God's people, happening in some kind of geographic vacuum. You know, as if they were the only ones around there, and that, you know, they were this isolated spot on the map and no one else was ever around them. But the fact is, they were in a highly desirable in a very populated area. A lot of different cultures, a lot of different people were around and wanted that dirt. They wanted that area because it was so highly desirable. And Judah had neighbors all along. They had neighbors when they split off from the northern kingdom of Israel. You know, they had neighbors, you know, throughout their succession of kings, all the good ones and the bad ones. They had neighbors while they were being carted off to exile. They had neighbors the whole time. And when the people of Judah got carted off into exile, those neighbors didn't just check the mail and put it on the doorstep, all that kind of stuff. They moved in. And they took over everything that God's people had taken for granted. The richness of the land and the geography, they took over all of it. And so these neighboring nations and people, they found themselves to be far more economically important to that whole area than they would have ever been before, because they took over all the resources that God's people had. And now, when the first exile started to come back, even that wasn't that big of a deal, because they didn't really pose much of a threat. There wasn't a whole lot going on. They were never able to get any traction or rebuild anything, because they just the neighbors kept coming in and stealing it all. And so again, two steps forward, 58 steps back. And so the neighbors didn't really care until Nehemiah came back. and started working on building up the defenses. So if we go back there to Nehemiah chapter 4, back to verses 7 through 9, so when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs, Ammonites, and Ashdodites heard that the work was going ahead and that the gaps in the wall of Jerusalem were being repaired, they were furious. They all made plans to come and fight against Jerusalem and throw us into confusion, but we prayed to our God and guarded the city day and night to protect ourselves. So there again, you see, Nehemiah, first thing, prays. Seeks God's protection, seeks God's will. How is this going to happen? And protected the city day and night. Now, remember again too, Sanballat and Tobiah, they just rattled their sabers a lot. They never actually did anything. It was a lot of bullying, a lot of intimidating, a lot of threatening, never actually attacked. But Nehemiah was not content to just assume that they were never going to do anything. And yet he prayed, but then he took action, proactive action. So if we look down in verse 16, but from then on, only half my men worked, while the other half stood guard with spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail. The leaders stationed themselves behind the people of Judah who were building the wall. The laborers carried on their work with one hand supporting their load and one hand holding a weapon. All the builders had a sword belted to their side. The trumpeter stayed with me to sound the alarm. Then I explained to the nobles and officials and all the people, the work is very spread out and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. When you hear the blast of the trumpet, rush to wherever it is sounding, then our God will fight for us. We worked early and late, from sunrise to sunset, and half the men were always on guard. I also told everyone living outside the walls to stay in Jerusalem. That way they and their servants could help with guard duty at night and work during the day. During this time, none of us, not I, nor my relatives, nor my servants, not the guards who were with me, ever took off our clothes. We carried our weapons with us at all times, even when we went for water. So half the people worked, half the people protected, and then they switched. Nehemiah sought God's help. He sought God's wisdom for how to deal with this. And so let me ask this question. Did Nehemiah really come up with the protection scheme for his people? I'll give you this example. Every day, I try to start my day, asking God for wisdom, guidance, and discernment for the day to come. So throughout the day, when a problem or situation arises and a solution comes, was that my brilliance? Probably not. Because usually what brings the situation that needs fixing is my brilliance. But so when the solution comes about, is that really me coming up with it? I'm going to go ahead and blame God. Because I started out the day asking Him to help me when I screw stuff up. Nehemiah asked God, how are we going to do this? We got to rebuild this wall, but now these people are threatening to come and attack us. How are we going to do it? God gives them the wisdom, the guidance, and then Nehemiah puts it into action. He stations people everywhere, has people armed to the teeth, ready to fight, comes up with the alarm system to alert everybody. An attack is coming, get here now. He wasn't content to just say, well, we're going to trust God with all of this. And I'm not trying to say it is a bad thing to trust God. Not at all. But here, Nehemiah wasn't content to just ask God for protection. He was also willing to be the hands by which God would protect. And he led the rest of the people to have the same attitude. And I especially love how there's both a personal and a communal awareness and readiness in that. You're working on your section. You are personally responsible and accountable for your wall. But when trouble arises in the community, all hands on deck. When you hear the sound of the trumpet, show up ready to fight. And that's exactly what he led the people to do. So what do we take away from Nehemiah's example? And when it comes to us protecting our integrity, our morality, the standards by which we live as followers of Christ, we have to be fully committed. And we have to take care of our own walls first. Remember that whole, you know, why are you pointing out the splinter in someone's eye and ignoring the log in your own thing? Somebody really smart said that. I think his name was Jesus. Take care of your walls first. Then look outward. Seek God's will and his wisdom and his guidance and his empowerment to live the standards that he has set, to follow fully and commit fully, but then put it into action. It's a common practice. A lot of well-meaning, well-intentioned followers of Christ do this. They allow themselves to get paralyzed in prayer. Praying's a great thing. But sometimes you gotta open your eyes and go get to work. Yes, we need to spend time with God in prayer, seeking his will and his guidance. But when he says go, go. Don't allow yourself to get paralyzed thinking that you have to commit absolutely every single choice, every moment to prayer. Pray. And then act when he says to. Those are the ways that we will protect the walls of integrity in our lives and in our families. Commit fully, fix your wall first, pray, and then act. So God, thank you. Thank you so much for who you are and for what you're doing in our lives. God, I just ask that in this moment you would be speaking to each one of our hearts and our minds, showing us the condition of our walls. Where do we need to patch? Where do we need to tear down and rebuild? Because God, we want to live the life that you have called us to live. We want the very best of everything you have in store for us. And so guide us and lead us to put into action and practice that which you would have us do. Lead us forward as we lead our families forward, as we lead this community forward to experience the very best of what you have, the dream that you have for our lives. And Jesus, we ask simply that you be honored and glorified in all of our attempts to follow you. In your name, amen.